Good morning. Welcome to Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you here listening, and we're also glad to have here in studio with us Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. This is our monthly show on home maintenance. We do it on a Monday, and if you have questions, now is the time to call in. Are you having some kind of a problem? Something needs to be repaired? You're thinking about making some changes, doing some remodeling? He knows an awful lot about all the various pieces and parts of the single-family home, so whether you need more space or you want to make your home more energy efficient or you just want to be more comfortable this winter or you got some kind of problem, any and all of that, it's great. All you got to do is pick up the telephone and give us a call, and he will do his best to help you out. 333-9455 is the number for Champaign-Urbana folks. Toll free, 800-222-9455. So that's toll free. If it would be a long distance call, use that number and the call's on us. You could also send us an email if you want. It's will-talk@illinois.edu. So at any point here, we got questions, we will take them. Thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you, David. Always a great time to come on here and always have fun with the questions that we get.
Okay. Anything in particular that's sort of on your mind that you might want to talk about?
Well, of course, winter is setting in, so furnaces are on. Make sure you got clean filters. It sounds redundant. I have to say that every couple of months. But, you know, the weather changes around here in Illinois fast enough that, you know, that's something we need to do. About every 2 to 3 months, you want to change that filter to make sure we get good airflow through the system. Your furnace will actually work more efficiently and save you money if it's getting proper air through it. If you've got a filter that's blocked up, the air moving through the furnace moves through at a slower rate because it doesn't get as much air to it. So yes, it comes out a little bit warmer, but it also means the heat exchanger stays at a higher temperature, so you have more heat going up and out through the flue pipe rather than being exchanged into the house air. So a good clean filter, good time for that. Of course, every time you do a filter, we're supposed to check batteries on smoke alarms and CO detectors and things like that.
Yeah, we just at our house, I guess one of the things that the idea it's promoted is when you change the clocks, put new batteries and smoke alarms. So I did go around and change all the batteries and smoke alarms. The thing about the filter, I guess I try to do that, but I don't think about it. Even the folks who make the filter are thoughtful enough to put a little sticker on it so that you can then put that onto the furnace and you can write the date on when you have done it so you don't have to remember it. Still, I don't do it as much as I probably should.
Well, the other thing when you're changing a filter is, since we are going from a cooling season to a heating season, it's a fairly drastic change in airflow patterns. Mm-hmm. Most of the furnaces in the Champaign-Urbana area in our local central Illinois area are a forced air heating system. And when you have a forced air system blowing cold air is heavier than warm air, so it tends to stay low. So you end up turning off most of your registers and ductwork on the lower level and blowing most of the cold air on the second floor. Well, obviously, this is not cooling. We're going into heating season, so we do what I call balancing the heating and cooling system, and that is to where we start rearranging which rooms get most of the airflow, since it's going to change. In the heating season, you don't need to have the air in the same rooms you did in the cooling season. So we start off heat down low, so you may want to turn off some of the registers in the upper level or some of the registers closer to the furnace if you're on a single family or a single level ranch, something to get the heat out and away. Also, I do like to recommend, because it is getting colder and we do want to save energy, that if you want to knock a couple of degrees off the thermostat, put all your large furniture, beds, sofas, things like that, on inside walls instead of outside walls. You'll feel more comfortable in the room, thereby allowing you to turn the thermostat down a degree or two and save a little bit of money over the winter time. If you have a bed underneath the window, it's going to feel colder in that room. Or if you have your big sofa underneath a big picture window, it's going to be chilly because glass does not have a good insulating value. The air next to the glass will get cold. Cold air is heavier. It falls down. So you end up with a cold draft blowing down over the top of you or dropping down over the top of you. I've had people say, my windows are so drafty. It's like, well, no. If you sit underneath that window, you're going to get cold. Your body acts as a radiant heater. You tend to radiate heat towards cool objects. So if you place yourself next to something that is cold, such as an outside wall, window, door, whatever, you're going to be colder in that room than if you were to place yourself someplace warmer, more towards an inside room or wall. the heat registers in most of the houses that we're building these days, we try and put the heat register itself underneath a window on the outside wall. And that tries to put a warm air barrier between you and the cooler object, the wall or window, to give you a better perceived comfort level. Not necessarily change the temperature in the room any, but make your body feel warmer in that room at that temperature. So don't want to block up off the registers and such that are behind the sofa or behind the chair by getting up too close and not getting that warm air past that window. So there's a couple little things that you can do. Balancing the system, find which room is the coldest. Start shutting down the registers to the warmer rooms. Let that cold room come up. Otherwise, you go from the warm room, where you're nice and toasty, go into the cold room. Oh, I'm cool. So you run over to the thermostat and bump it up two or three degrees, trying to get it a little bit warmer in the house. You go back to the other room. Wow, I can take my sweater off here. So balancing the system so the house is all about even on temperature is really a good way of increasing the comfort level while still being able to say, hey, I'm going to drop a couple degrees and see if I can save a little bit of energy.
Yeah. And when you talk about shutting off the registers, people should understand what you're not talking about the place in the room where the air comes out. You're talking about you got to go down into the basement or wherever your ductwork are and look for the dampers that are in the ducts. That's what you're talking about.
Well, yes and no. The dampers do most of the work. Hopefully when they installed the furnace, they did a main trunk damper, which if you have a two-story house, which will adjust between upstairs and downstairs. Mm. Sometimes they'll put in individual dampers for individual duct runs so you can shut off a family room or a den or something like that. But quite often they are not accessible, especially if you have a finished basement. So you can use just the register grills themselves in the floor. So it's a combination of things. What your furnace has is what your options are. I know that high-end furnaces, particularly on big houses where we have one unit to do a large house, we can have electronically controlled dampers so that you can have two or three different thermostats in the house to control one furnace, and it just opens up dampers. So if upstairs needs heat, it closes off the two downstairs and turns the furnace on and blows it upstairs. One of the other one needs heat, then it'll open up the damper, and so that furnace can then service more in one area of the house. Mm-hmm. So there's several different ways of directing the air around.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Scott Spies is with us from the Spies Home Inspection Service. He's on the program once a month, always on a Monday. We talk about home maintenance. And if you have questions, you got problems, you need some advice, give us a call, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. We also have a toll-free line. Go anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. And if you want, you could send an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. And now we're at the point where I think, at least looking around the place where I live, it seems like most of the leaves have come down. So I'm thinking about cleaning out my gutters. Is it probably we now at the time when it would be a good thing to be doing that?
Oh, yeah, of course. Now that we do have most of our leaves down, because they do tend to fill up the gutters quite rapidly, particularly that pesky little sycamore tree that's two blocks down that seems to be able to get the leaves down the entire block.
Yeah.
The guy that has a tree doesn't seem to be able to have to pick his leaves up. They tend to blow down my direction. I don't know how that happens. But, yeah, cleaning out the gutters. So, of course, when we start getting ice in there, we don't end up with a complete ice dam or ice buildup in the gutters. I've seen the gutters fill up with enough ice to actually pull them loose from the house and things like that. So have them clean before we go into winter will help.
Right. We have some callers here. We will talk with them, and I think we'll start. They're both in Champaign. We'll start with line one right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Thank you for taking my call,
sure.
David.
Mm-hmm.
I'm considering having my house re-sited. The contractor is proposing to put a foam insulation on under the siding, and I'm concerned about the moisture issues of having a moisture barrier on the outside of the house. Can you please discuss that? I'll listen offline.
Well, generally speaking, when they put on a vinyl siding, it is quite common to put in a thin fan fold foam insulation. This is about an eighth of an inch thick foam board. It does give a little bit of insulating value, not a lot. It doesn't act that much as a vapor barrier because they don't generally tape and seal all the edges, and it has some small perforations through it so that air will go through, or moisture will go through it. Air doesn't, but moisture can move through it. It's already on the outside of the house, which we should already have some type of weather barrier behind your existing siding. When they put on the fan fold, it's usually because they're putting over the top of siding. They're not removing the old siding. It does help the new siding lay flatter and look better. So from that standpoint, I would say it's not going to be an issue as a true vapor barrier. It's not like it's taped and sealed, and it's not like it's completely airtight or watertight. And it does help the appearance of the siding because it does let it, doesn't let the old siding telegraph through the new siding as far as where it's at, you know, how it's mounted, whatever. Mm-hmm. You've got an 8-inch lap board and your vinyl siding can have a little bit of a wave to it. So I would say you're all right with the fan fold. They do tend to market it a little bit as a big insulating barrier, and I'd have to say that the insulation quality of the fan fold is minimal, but it does help reduce a little bit of airflow through the house. So it does provide some additional insulation and some additional interior comfort, but more than anything else, it makes the siding job look a lot better.
Okay, I hope that helps. If the caller wants to follow up, he certainly may. We'll go on, though, to another caller. This is also Champaign and line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My problem concerns my roof, and I had a new roof put on in 2004. And since that time, every room in my house has sprung leaks. Now, the people who installed it have been very responsive, but they haven't solved the problem. And I have a cathedral ceiling in the living room and some cross beams that are now getting water stained, and I'm afraid that those beams are compromised. It has gone clear across the house from the living room, the screen porch, dining room, kitchen, family room, and bedroom. There have been leaks in all of those rooms. The last time they were here, I asked them to just replace the roof. I think there must be something defective in the shingles, but they keep saying, no, they're going to fix it. But, you know, they come 6-8 times a year since 2004.
Okay, actual leaks when it rains, we actually have to get pans out and catch drips. Is that what we're looking at?
Yes.
Okay, so it's not something where you just start noticing water stains, but you actually get leaks going through.
Yes, and it's gone down to the lower level from the roof. I have a two-level house.
All right, I'd say the roof is not installed correctly. Something's got to be wrong in order for it to leak that much. Oftentimes I've had instances where somebody's put a new roof on and we end up with mysterious water stains showing up and we've had condensation problems. But if you've actually got to put a pan out and catch some drips when it does rain out, that is not a condensation issue. It's something wrong with the roofing or the flashing, something that they did incorrectly. That's one of those things where you almost have to look at it, find out what they did, call them up and call them on it and say, okay, this is not right. We need to fix this. Because if you've got them coming out that often, yes, they should be responsible not only for fixing the leaks, but you might want to start talking to them about being responsible for the damage inside the house as well. Because if they've had to come back and fix it that much, they've got a problem with the installation job.
Okay, well, they've already fixed some of the damage in the house, but it has leaked again, so they have to refix it.
At which point do we say we need to call in another roofer and then may have to go into some litigation about getting some money back for the new roofer? I hate doing things like that if the company can't stand behind it. I mean, they seem to be standing behind it by coming out there and looking at it, but I can also see your standpoint of getting quite aggravated with having to call them out and having water drips, particularly in the middle of the tea party or something like that when you're entertaining, we end up with water dripping in the middle of the table. It's not a good sign.
Well, so is this something that a home inspector could help guide me with?
Yes, it is. A home inspector or another qualified roofer should be able to give you a good idea on what should have been done and how it would have been easier for them to correct it the first time. And also, I would have to actually see it. Somebody would have to actually look at it to see what they're doing to, quote-unquote, repair the roof. I mean, if they're just slapping a little bit of silicone or tar around a joint or two, that may or may not be the answer. They may not have got the proper flashing underneath the shingles. Do you not remember if it was a complete re-roof, or did they just put another layer over the top of the existing shingles?
I think they took off the old roof and put new shingles down.
Okay. It sounds to me like they missed some of the flashing or didn't get a flashing in correctly, because really the shingles themselves, water can't get through the shingle, and if it lays down properly and bonds properly, we shouldn't be getting water through shingles. We should be getting water at joints. Occasionally we can get snow and wind blowing rain through the vent systems around your ridge vents or around
your button vents. Well, they put in a new ridge vent. They've reflashed the chimney. They've done one whole section of the roof over again, but I still have leaks. At first they were saying it was my skylights, but they taped the skylights and put Visqueen over them, and it wasn't the skylights.
Okay. Yeah, it sounds like we need to get somebody out there other than that company, because if they've been there that many times and haven't been able to track it down, they may need an extra suggestion or two.
Okay, very good. Well, expect a call. Thank you so much.
All right, thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Okay, bye-bye.
We're talking this morning with Scott Spees from the Spees Home Inspection Service. He's been with us many times here. We do this program regularly. It's always once a month. It's always on a Monday, and it's your chance to call in and ask questions about home maintenance problems. 333-9455 is the Champaign-Urbana number, and toll-free 800-222-9455. We have someone else here in Champaign. Line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah. Hi. I have a question regarding our room, which actually we had a three-car tandem garage. We converted one of the garages into a family room, and it has, of course, concrete flooring. We have put carpet on top with padding, but that room gets really cold. So we do have a fireplace there, but, you know, if you turn it on, it gets really toasty. But otherwise, it's extremely cold when we come down in the morning. And we do have vents in that room, but they don't seem to be doing a lot of work there. So I just wanted to know what to do to make the room, the floor feel warmer. I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, that's going to be kind of a tricky one, because when you do a conversion on that type where you have an existing concrete slab that was originally intended as a garage, they don't do the same edge insulation that they would if we were putting in a concrete slab for a living room or a living area. So what you're lacking is the edge insulation. So, yes, what will happen is the outside air hits the foundation walls. The foundation walls get cold, and it will tend to pull the heat from the concrete slab. There's no good easy way of doing it. There are a couple different radiant type heating systems that you can actually put down on the floor. They're usually designed more for small areas such as bathrooms, where we can put them under ceramic tile and put a thermostat on it. In this case, you could probably put in a supplemental electric baseboard heater in a couple areas around the outside walls that would work on a separate thermostat. So that during the evenings at night when things are really cooling off, those little baseboard heaters can help keep the outside walls a little bit warmer. Set them a couple of degrees cooler than your primary heating system. That way, during the day when the sun's out and the siding's warm, probably the electric baseboard won't run as often. It's very difficult to run ductwork to the proper places in a conversion room like that, because there's no ducts underneath the concrete. So you end up putting your ductwork from your forced air furnace on an inside wall. Well, the inside wall isn't the one that gets cold. The outside wall is the ones that get cold. So what we really need is a heat source around one of those outside walls, such as a supplemental electric baseboard heater on a different thermostat. You might be able to do a little bit of work with some insulation around the perimeter. Any wall that's on the outside where the concrete block is showing, we could put some insulation there. Actually, the insulation should go down about 15 inches, where they actually insulate the foundation wall. Of course, if you put a foam insulation on an outside wall, foam deteriorates with sunlight, so then you've got to put a coating over the foam insulation. So you cover it with a concrete, what they call a dry vit, which is just a thin concrete coating, kind of trowels on. A little bit thicker than a paint, but not by much. And that'll help reduce some of the heat loss to the slab. It's very typical to have issues when a garage conversion like that is done unless we put in a different heat source, because we're just not putting the heat in the area that we would normally have it. Years back in the 20s and 30s, we used to have these big furnaces that were centrally located in the middle of the house, and all the hot air went up the middle. And the houses felt drafty and cold. That's because our outside walls didn't have any heat going to them. So now we've decided in this area that we put all of our heat, as I've indicated earlier, in heat registers under windows on outside walls. In your garage conversion, that didn't happen. So, yes, that room will feel colder. So my guess is that we're going to have to do a supplemental heat system. There are systems that, like say, you can put on the concrete and then put like a ceramic tile or something, but I don't know of any of them that will work with the carpeting. The carpeting does help keep your feet from getting any colder when walking on the concrete, but it doesn't help warm the concrete. So the concrete will try and stay roughly 55 degrees year-round, and that's what the soil temperature is underneath the concrete, and concrete does transfer heat slowly, but does transfer heat, so it will probably stay at about 55 degrees. So if you can put a little bit of heat around the outside walls away from where your current ductwork is, it'll probably bring up the perceived comfort level of the house.
Okay. Well, again, hope that helps. Other questions are welcome. 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. You can shoot us an email, will-talk@illinois.edu. I know that there are a lot of people who like the idea of that kind of radiant heat in the floor, because what it does is it puts the heat where you are, where you want it. We're living on the floor, we're walking on the floor, and it can make a lot of difference to your comfort if the floor feels warm. Now, that also probably is the kind of thing that if you're building a house, you can put that in. It's not very easy to go back and do that afterwards.
It can actually be done afterwards, provided you're putting down a proper floor system. There's no good heating system that goes on the floor when you cover it with carpet, because the carpet does act as an insulator, and you don't want to put your heat in and then put insulation on top of it between you and the heat source. Mm-hmm. So it works for when you're putting in like a ceramic floor, where we were staying with a masonry product. So a lot of times you'll see them in bathrooms and such, a little, I think they called it a morning warmer or something like that. That was one brand where they heat a 8x10 room bathroom or a 6x8 bathroom. And so for small areas that works well. But for a garage slab, unless you're going to redo the whole thing, it's not going to be quite as efficient. There's some ceiling radiant heat systems that can be put in. A radiant heat doesn't necessarily need to heat the air temperature as much as it tends to heat the objects in the room, such as the people, chairs, tables, things like that. But from a cost standpoint, I'm not sure that a ceiling radiant heat system would be as cost effective as just a baseboard heat that we could use as supplemental.
Yeah.
Let's face it, here in Champaign-Urbana, we don't get minus 2 degrees below zero for 5 days at a time on a regular basis. You know, I think the longest one I remember lately is in the last decade, we had a week and a half where it never got above zero. But we don't have really sub-zero temperatures on a regular basis. And we end up with days, a lot of our winter days are 30 degrees, 28.5 degrees. And it's not that much more difficult to add just a little bit of heat on those particular days rather than have to put in a great big, huge radiant system for that one room. So.
Yeah.
Just a little supplemental. Now, I'm not talking about these little plug-in heaters, the portable ones. I'm talking about a wall-mounted, baseboard-mounted, hardwired supplemental heat system.
Okay. We have another caller here, somebody on cell phone over in Vermilion County on our line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Seems to be insulation day. I have a little house which, when we finally climbed up in the attic, it was built 40 years ago, 1971 or so. And come to find out that all of the bats that were up there, R19 fiberglass, were installed upside down, which explains why there's such a musty smell. Anyway, that's all gone. We took it out and disposed of it. So now we're sitting with an attic that's drying out and getting rid of some of the moldy ceiling wallboard that is going to be cut out and replaced, etc. So when it's finally all perfect again in the ceilings, what sort of insulation do you recommend? Should we roll the bats out or call up somebody with blow-in or foam or what do you think?
Well, I'm going to say that you're probably better off going with a blown-in insulation. The bat insulation works well, but it's hard to get to go around light fixtures, extra bracing, wiring, things like that that are up in the attic. The blown-in insulation fills in a lot better. It does help to put a short piece of fiberglass bat out towards your soffit area. In other words, any open area, if you go up in the attic and you turn off the lights and you can see daylight coming in at the soffit areas.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Lots of it's in the air, too.
Well, good. Well, that's good, actually. Attic ventilation, there is no such thing as too much attic ventilation until we start allowing water in. So more attic ventilation is good. But you want to make sure that if wind blows in through the soffits, that it's not blowing the loose fill back. So usually by putting in a 2-foot section of bat-type insulation, which tends to be a little more rigid or stays in place a little easier, out that direction. Now, you don't want to block up that soffit ventilation, so you may have to put in some air chutes, which are a little plastic or styrofoam piece that go up against the bottom of the roof sheathing and out to the soffit area. So you can put your fiberglass insulation up to the air chute and not block that ventilation from the soffit vent, and then come in and blow the insulation in. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, how deep should that be? What's the R value that's recommended these?
Right now in this area, if you're going fresh in an attic, I would go with an R50.
50?
R50.
And how much and how what depth would you have to get a 50?
You're probably going to need about 13 to 15 inches.
Oh, boy. Okay. Sounds like fun. Okay. Thank you.
And I think you'll find that most of the companies that do the blown-in will probably install it for less money than you can run out and go to the big box store and buy it and do it yourself.
Well, after having spent 2 days up there, I think I have to agree with you. I will let somebody else go up there and finish this job.
Yeah, I know I found a surprise when I did mine 15, 18 years ago that I went out and priced the insulation, and then I called somebody, and the price difference was about $45 more the other direction. In other words, it was going to cost me $45 more if I did it myself than if I hired somebody.
Oh, heavens. Okay.
So they can buy the insulation for less than we can, so therefore they buy it in bulk and blow it in, and they're there for 20 or 30 minutes or 45 minutes, and boom, they're out of there. It would have taken me half a day and would have cost more to begin with. So.
A lot of backaches, too. Okay. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We're talking this morning about home maintenance. It's something we do every month on the show. Scott Spies is the guest. We'll take some more questions in a moment here. First, we'll take a short break. This is Focus.
AM 580 thanks Champaign Danville Overhead Doors for its support of Focus. Champaign Danville Overhead Doors offers pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer warranties. Champaign Danville Overhead Doors is pleased to support public radio in Central Illinois on behalf of its customers and business associates.
This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week. Hour number two, we'll be talking with Maria Tatar. She is she chairs the program in folklore and mythology at Harvard University, has written a lot about folklore, folk tales, fairy tales, and she has a new book out that is sort of honoring the fact that it's been 100 years since the publication of the novel that really introduced a lot of the world to Peter Pan. And so she has an annotated version of this that's out. The book also has a lot of information on the J.M. Barrie, the man who wrote it, and how the story has been treated over the years. And there's some interesting, important connections between the man and his life and the story. So we'll talk about that in the second hour today. Tomorrow morning in the first hour, the guest is William Arkin. He's an investigative journalist. He's a columnist with The Washington Post. And we'll be talking about a book that he has co-authored. The title is Top Secret America, which takes a look at the growth of the security apparatus of the U.S. government since 9/11. It has certainly gotten big, but the question is, does it make us safer? And he and his co-author, Dana Priest, who also works at the Washington Post, argued, no, actually, it hasn't really made us safer. More on that tomorrow in hour two. As I say, we're here from 10 to noon, Monday through Friday. You can check the schedule and listen to past programs by going to the website, which is wyll.illinois.edu. In this hour, Scott Spies is with us. He's on the show once a month. He's a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service, and we are here open to whatever questions you might have about home maintenance, 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana folks. We have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. And you can send us an email at will-talk@illinois.edu. I think you wanted to sort of make a qualification here about what about figuring out how much insulation you need. It does depend on what it is you've already got there.
Yeah, our callers indicated that they had no insulation up there at the moment, so they're putting in all new. If you've got an R30 or an R40, it's not going to be cost effective to come in there and add another 4 inches or so over the top of it. The R value is an inverse proportion to heat loss. So if I have an R30, 1/30th of the heat that gets that surface over a given period of time passes through, the other 29 parts are reflected back. Well, the difference between an R30 and an R60 is 1/30th. So by adding another, 8 inches of insulation, I save 1/30th of the heat loss that I had, but I was only losing 1/30th of my heat. So it's kind of a diminishing return. So if you've already got, I'm gonna start with a number roughly an R25 to an R30. I probably would not say go out there and go make sure you fluffed it up and get it back up to R50 or add some more insulation. Now, if you've got an R11 bat, which is a 3.5-inch bat, usually those were installed in the 60s. Sometimes they're up to the early 70s. In the 70s, we started going to an R19. The reason we keep going with more and more insulation is, of course, our energy costs keep going up and up. And as the energy costs go up, it's more cost effective to add insulation and reduce some of our energy loss. Now, unfortunately, the tighter we make the houses, the less airflow we get. And everybody's seen articles on sick houses. And one of the problems we have is mold and mildew because we're tightening up our houses. We're not getting airflow through them. Mm-hmm. Grandma's house, which, back in the day, the curtains would move when the windows were closed because it had enough air going through it, and we had to put pans of water on the radiators to get enough humidity to keep from getting the static shock going across the room, things like that. Okay, those days are gone. Those houses are now being tightened up. We're putting in new windows and new insulation. The new houses are built super tight. So now what we actually have to watch for is too much moisture in the house. Normal cooking, cleaning, showering all puts humidity into the house. And if we're not getting an air exchange through the house, we have to really worry about, am I getting too much moisture? So on newer houses, we got to make sure that vent fans from bathrooms and such are vented to the outside. Attics have much better ventilation. I would have to say a lot of roofs get replaced early because of too much moisture in the house and the house not being able to breathe. Now, I'm not saying we want to be able to get 30 air exchanges in a 24-hour period. That's the old farmhouse. But we need to get 2 or 3 air exchanges minimum. So even on the super tight houses, they're now starting to put in air exchange systems to where you can take the air in the house, take the heat out of it, blow it outside, bring in the air from outside, put the heat back in it so that we end up exchanging that air and help moving things around.
Okay.
So, putting in too much insulation, if you put in too much and don't get any airflow through the house, that's one problem. But it's also one of those, the point I was wanting to get out was that it was a diminishing return, that if you've got an R30, something that was put in the 80s or 90s, I probably don't need to run right out there and say, ooh, I need to go put another 4 or 5 inches of insulation on top of this. Yeah. It may or may not pay back immediately.
Okay. And is it for your average person to go up in your attic, is it easy to figure out what it is that you actually do have? Is it all about how thick it is?
The insulation that we have in central Illinois, central Indiana areas, yes, it is pretty much a thickness. Mm. Insulation is merely a way of reducing airflow. Stagnant air is actually one of the best insulators. When you have a double pane glass window, we have 2 panes of glass with an inert gas or an airspace in between them. That airspace is actually our insulator, just air that can't move. If the air doesn't move, it doesn't transfer the heat from one pane to the next. If the air moves, then it does transfer heat. So moving air will transfer heat, but stagnant air doesn't. So what we're doing is we're putting in fiberglass, cellulose, foam, something up in the attic which resists the air movement. And when we have that air sitting still in that pile of loose stuff, that air is not transferring heat. So it's only when the air is lifting or rising up through there, getting a little bit of thermal lift, that's when we're getting our heat loss. So, yeah, anything that helps reduce the airflow through there.
Okay. Well, again, questions are certainly welcome. We've got plenty of time here, about 15 minutes left in this part of Focus. 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. And again, if you'd like to send an email, you can do that too, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, just for in terms of what, if you were in a situation like the caller where you had maybe had some insulation in your attic and it was old and you just thought, well, okay, let's start fresh. And you took out whatever was there. So you're starting from nothing. So it is the using the blown in, is it just in terms of both ease of application and also making sure that you just don't have air spots? That's why you think, rather than fiberglass bats, that's probably why that you think that one works better.
Yeah, it's going to be more cost effective because it does go in much faster. So time is money. If it takes the installer 2 hours to put insulation in, or it takes the installer 30 minutes to put the insulation in, you're going to have a cost savings there. The loose fill insulation, as long as we don't have air, gale winds blowing through the attic, the loose fill insulation is going to stay in place. That's why we put in the air chutes, and that's why if we have large vents, I do recommend throwing some fiberglass bats out towards the outside edges to help reduce that. It's not that uncommon. I've been up in a lot of attics where two or three of the vents have the insulation blown back as a matter of pushing it back out there. But if there's been a fiberglass bat in that area, it would have done that. Mm-hmm. If you just put out the fiberglass bat, now you've got the gaps between the bats, particularly when we start talking R30 and greater in fiberglass bats. An R30 is an 8-inch bat. Or a 9-inch bat. If you put in a 9-inch bat around 2x4 framing, you've got a gap between it. For the 4 inches you'd put around the truss, but then for the 5 inches above that, there's this gap, and the loose fill tends to fill in areas like that. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I would say loose fill from a cost effective standpoint. If you've got an R19, a 6-inch fiberglass bat, it's a great idea to blow in another 4 or 5 inches of loose fill over the top. It will improve the performance of the insulation you've already got, in addition to bringing you back up into an area where we're not going to be losing quite as much heat.
Okay. We have some other callers here and an email here. Why don't I do the email and wait to the callers. Someone writes here, we have a nice large wood-burning fireplace, but we'd like some tips on how to utilize the heat from the fireplace. There are no vents or blowers that we know of, just a chimney that goes straight up through the roof. We turn the ceiling fan on low in reverse in that room, but if there's some way to get better use of the heat, they'd like to do that. So what might you suggest?
And that's a tricky one. Most of the time, fireplaces are used for 3 to 4 hours in the evening. And after you've used the fireplace, then you have to leave the flue open as the timbers burn down and the gases continue to escape. A good fire can take 10, 12, 14 hours to cool down after the flames are down and it's stopped putting out heat. So meanwhile, we have this 8-inch hole or 10-inch hole in the middle of the house with the flue taking everything up. So just from what I've noticed, if you're not burning the fireplace in excess of 18 hours a day, you're probably losing more heat than you're saving. So, the efficiency of a fireplace is somewhere between plus and minus 5%. So it could actually cost you heat. It's not gaining you a lot of heat. It gives you a nice, warm, cozy feeling, but it's not really gaining you any heat unless you've got a specific system designed for heating with wood. There are some heat-elator inserts, basically pieces that will slide into the firebox that you set the wood on. It has a fan system which will blow air through tubes, and then the tubes come out to the outside so that you can take house air, run it through the firebox, blow it back out, and that will bring some of the heat back in. But again, unless you're burning that fireplace 8, 10, 12, 16 hours, you've got to leave the flue open for that amount of time just to let things cool down. So all the heat you've collected now goes back out through this big 8-inch hole. So glass doors will help. When the fire is dying down and not putting off a lot of heat, you can close off the glass doors and reduce some of the air going up through the flue, since we can't close the flue. The blower systems, like I say, there are several different ones that will be in that would fit in there, could be retrofitted into your unit. But you're not going to get a lot of efficient heat out of a wood-burning fireplace.
Yeah. All right. We have some other callers here. Next, talk to someone in Fithian. Line one. Hello.
Hello. Is solar panels for generating photovoltaics, are they getting close to being worthwhile investing with the, you know, the incentives the government's giving and the threat of increase by Ameren and all of that? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay.
Oh, well, that opens up a whole new can of worms. Solar heat's been tried in this area since the 70s. Actually, when my father was with the University of Illinois Small Homes Council Building Research Council, we had a couple of solar panels up in there, and they were measuring things. And the basic conclusion was, no, it doesn't work here.
Because we have too many cloudy days.
Well, and I say here because in some areas they do work. And, yes, we don't have as many bright sunny days where we're getting the solar gain. And so the expense of the panels, the expense of the maintenance on the panels, they found that the panels in as little as 6 to 8 months could drop 20% to 30% in their efficiency. So if you're looking at, okay, I'm going to put a solar panel up here. It's good for 15 years. Here's how much heat I'm getting out of it. Well, if it drops in 6 months, it drops 20 or 30%. All your efficiency numbers just went out the window. So places that use solar heat find solar energy for either charging batteries or storing energy or heating water find that unless they do regular maintenance, cleaning the panels or replacing covers on the panels, they really don't seem to do that much. Now, as energy costs do go up and solar panel technology goes up, they are becoming more and more feasible. I'm not going to say likely to show up, but more feasible. Now, if you're in Colorado where you're up at 8,000 feet and you've got little or no UV blocking the sun, you're going to get a lot more out of a solar panel than we are down here in the Midwest where we're 600 and 700 feet above sea level instead of 8,000 feet. Mm-hmm. You get out California, you get it in the sunny states, Texas, Florida, something like that, where we've got a lot more sunlight. They do make more sense. But I'm going to have to say at this point in time, with the energy costs that we've got, the technology on the solar panels, and the air quality that we have in this area, is probably not a good investment.
All right. There you go. We'll talk again with some other folks here. Next person in line is in Aurora, line number four. Hello.
Yes, good morning.
Uh-huh.
You and I, we have talked about this in the past, but I was talking to you about insulating between the floor, you know, in the basement, between the floor and the foundation, that gap up there. And, of course, you know, I talked to you about my concerns with fiberglass, but you did, and you said the vapor barrier has to go to the outside. Is that correct?
No, it has to go towards the inside. The vapor barrier always goes on the warm side of the insulation.
Oh, it does?
Yes.
Okay. Because I don't know why I had it in my head that it had to go to the outside, because then I said, well, then that fiberglass is exposed, and I didn't really want that in the living area. But so what I was calling about today, so that kind of but anyway, I had seen this product, and I know it's not new, but it's made out of, like, recycled denim. You know what I'm talking about? I saw it. It's at a big box store flyer that I just...
Yes, I have seen that.
And I was wondering what your thoughts were on that particular product.
It's relatively dense. It doesn't have as much airflow through it, but it is safe and it is relatively dense. It reduces a lot of the airflow. I haven't read up on it. I have seen it, and I know they were touting that you know, it didn't itch when you put it in and things like that, because it is made out of a fluffier material, not a fiberglass, not a spun glass.
Got a recycled denim or something like that.
Yeah, and it's been treated with a chemical, so it's fire resistant and smolder resistant. So yes, it's going to be more along the lines of the cellulose insulation, which is quite good. This stuff, if it's cost effective, I did not look at the price at it when I was over there the other day. I've been doing some remodel on a bathroom, so I've been making regular trips out and walk past that. The material you're actually talking about, and did take a quick minute to look at it. Yeah, it would be effective for that. You do not need any vapor barrier there in that band joist area if you don't want to put one in. If you do have a fiberglass or some type of insulation that has a vapor barrier should be on the inside or the warm side. So, yes, that material would, if it's easy to work with, and it did appear that you could cut it and tear it fairly easily. The only concern would be how easy it does it pull apart, because when you're putting it in the band joist area where we need it 16 inches wide by 8 or 10 inches tall, you're going to have to take a piece and cut it an awful lot of times, whereas a piece of fiberglass is pretty easy. Lay a board on it, take a box knife and slice it once and it cuts. So I don't know how well the stuff cuts, how easy it would install in that particular instance.
Oh, I understand, right. One other question I have in regards to my attic. Years ago, I don't, for the life of me, I should have gone up there and looked. I knew you were going to be on today. I should have gone up and looked at the insulation. This would have been back in the 90s, and it was pink. It had this, like, it was kind of came in a roll, but it had it's kind of like wrapped in a vapor barrier, but with slits cut in it. Does that ring a bell with you?
It's got kind of a white plastic wrapping on it.
Well, this was kind of pink. What's pink plastic
okay.
wrapping? I was thinking.
Yeah.
But I was just wondering, did I goof up by putting that across the top of my old insulation?
No, because that stuff does not have a vapor barrier. That is basically just to encapsulate the fibers. There for a while, everybody was worried about fiberglass coming up with the same effects as we had with asbestos. So they started doing a full plastic wrap on the fiberglass mats. And it was perforated so that it was not a moisture barrier.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, that is perfectly safe. It's a good material. It's nice and easy to install. It doesn't get a lot of dust floating around. So I would say you're good.
Thank you very much.
All right, very good. Thank you. To the next caller here, this is someone in Savoy. Line number one.
Hi.
Hi.
The perimeter of our crawl space does have the insulation with the barrier on the inside, but over time it's kind of bulged loose from the wall a little bit, like air has maybe gotten through there from the window wells or something. Do I need to make sure that's pushed back tight against the foundation or not?
As long as the panels aren't falling off the wall, you're in good condition.
Okay. But they are, but the other problem is on the ceiling part of the crawl space, the strips of insulation do not have a wrapping on them, and they had been poked up between the joists, and gravity is bringing them down. And is there some kind of a horizontal, we can poke them back up again, but is there some kind of device that we can figure out to hold them back up again?
They actually do sell pieces of wire cut in 16-inch lengths that you can use that would you'd put them up between the joists, and it basically give you a little bridge to help hold up the insulation. If you've got the insulation on the perimeter walls, the outside walls,
mm-hmm.
you really don't need it on the floors.
Oh, okay, but as long as it's there, it's in the way when it's drooping. And so I guess it's still just as well keep it and put those 16-inch wires.
Well, maybe. If all the ductwork from your furnace runs through the crawl space?
No, electric heating.
Okay, then yes, you go ahead and put that up. They make little wires. I think a roll of 100 costs like about $7 or $8 for 100 of these little wires, and you put them in about every 3 feet or so, and you just push them up in there, and they'll bow up, and they've been cut at an angle, so they act like a little nail, so they hold themselves up in place quite nicely.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Great
right.
program.
Very good. Thank you. About a minute or two left. Someone wants to call real quick. So does it make sense to insulate crawl space walls?
Yes. The walls, the perimeter walls, the outside walls, mm-hmm. are where mm-hmm. I'd like to see the insulation installed, because the outside walls are the ones that are going to be exposed to colder temperatures. The soil surface in the crawl space, it's going to be about 55 degrees pretty much year-round. All right, 55 degrees is, I'm going to call it a heat source, because mm-hmm. it's not cold. It's not real hot. It's not warm, but it's not cold. Cold is going to be 30 degrees. So your outside walls can be exposed to not only outdoor temperatures of zero, but for the first 8 inches or so, we get down to what we call a frost line. Anything below about 15 inches below the surface of the soil, we're pretty much 55 degrees. We very rarely get a freeze where our frost line or our 32-degree mark is much more than about 8 or 10 inches down. Mm-hmm. But since about 8 or 10 inches inches of your foundation are actually above that line, you know, we've got 20, 25 inches of foundation, which are cold. If we insulate that, then the heat, the 55-degree soil, doesn't sit there and radiate out towards the cold walls. When you've got, I would say that 90% of the heating done in this area is done with the forced air furnace. And most of the time, if you've got a crawl space, the ductwork is going through the crawl space. The ductwork is not sealed 100%. Almost impossible to do. It takes hours. If you have some loss from the ductwork, that will warm the floors in the room above, because your warm air in the crawl space, warm air rises. So if we get warm air going into the crawl space, it wants to run up to the bottom of the floor. So as long as we're not radiating that warm air towards the outside walls, it actually makes the house more comfortable. So insulating the floors. Now, the caller just indicated that they had electric heat, so they had no heat source in the crawl space whatsoever. So with the electric heat, then, yes, they could insulate the floors, insulate the walls, insulate the floors. That 60-degree or 55-degree crawl space is going to stay 55 degrees. If you've got a forced air furnace, that crawl space, it's very common for me to get down in the crawl spaces. It's 60, 65 degrees. It's quite comfortable in the crawl spaces with just a little bit of heat loss, and that's going up and warming the floors.
Okay, but you do want to make sure you do have your vapor barrier, though, down over the soil in the crawl space.
Oh, that's something we've beat so many times that I figured I wasn't even going to bring that up.
You didn't even need to mention that? Okay.
Yeah, there has to be a vapor barrier over the top of any exposed soil. I don't care if it's in a basement, if it's in a crawl space, if it's under an addition. If you can see the dirt, we need to get plastic over the top of it, because you will get water up into the house.
Well, we got to leave it at that. I'm sorry we have a caller we cannot take, but next month Scott will be back, and we'll do it again. Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service on once a month, always on a Monday, for these home maintenance shows. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, David.